This is the First Time Podcast.
It's us talking writing and publishing.
Welcome to our Masters series,
where we interview Australian and international authors at the top of their games.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Masters series. Our featured book today is Marshmallow, the second novel from Victoria Hannan. This segment is brought to you by Hachette. Victoria Hannan is a writer and photographer. Her first novel, Kokomo, was the 2019 winner of the Victorian Premier's Literary Award for an unpublished manuscript, and her second novel, Marshmallow, is out now. We spoke to Victoria in season 4, and you can find out more about her initial path to publication in that conversation. But Victoria Hannan, welcome back to the First Time Podcast.
Hello, Kate Mildenhall. Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on Marshmallow. It's brilliant, gripping, it's tender, and I and others have all predicted that it will be the book that everyone is talking about in the months to come. Can you please tell us what your novel Marshmallow is about and where it came from?
Marshmallow is the story of five friends who witness a tragic accident, and then we meet them a year later to look at how the grief and the trauma from that accident has rippled through their lives. I think the initial idea came from this time a couple of years ago when I was in Tasmania for a few weeks and ended up on the beach with a woman who about 6 years earlier had lost a child in a tragic accident. And I was on this beach just kind of bearing witness to her pain. And it really started me thinking about how people can even start to get on with their lives after something terrible like that has happened.
I want to go on to talk about the fact that the novel is about grief, but it's also about friendship. What is it about friendship that you wanted to explore in the novel?
I think similarly to Kokomo, which is also a novel about friendship, not everyone is always blessed to have an incredibly stable or present family. And so sometimes they have to choose their family. And I think sometimes those friendships that you choose can become some of the most important friendships or relationships of your lives. And also some people don't have a romantic partner that they can lean on for support. And so you look around you and you see that you have these people that have been with you through the ups and downs and through the drunken nights out and the vomiting the next morning, and you realize that they're the kind of the loves of your life, I guess. And so in my life, my friendships have always been incredibly important to me, have been the people, you know, they've been the people that got me through really hard times, sent me a bunch of flowers when something terrible has happened. And I don't know that there are enough novels out there that actually explore those relationships. There's often the novel about the dysfunctional family or the romantic relationship that's falling apart. But to have really kind of positive friendship stories is quite rare.
The book's described as being about the ripple effect of grief, and the structure, which revolves around multiple points of view from these different friends, kind of allows or asks the reader to experience that ripple. Did you always know that you wanted to structure the book in this way, and how many iterations did it take to get it right?
I always knew that I wanted it to be a story from multiple people's point of view, because I'm also really interested in the way different people experience the same event. And also I wanted to explore the different ways that grief can affect different people, as well as also looking at the way that lived experience of ill mental health can affect that, or previous traumas can affect that, or also the privileges that you experience in your life can affect that. And that was impossible to do through just one character. Structurally, it definitely changed a lot. I had an original draft of this in 2019 that was from five people's point of view, but was a completely different novel. And then throughout 2020, I'd thought about it quite a lot and had this idea that the story was going to ripple in to tell the story of one particular character and then ripple back out through the other characters, then back into that one central character, then back out. And I tried to write that, but it just wasn't really working. And so at some point I changed it, and because I saw that it wasn't serving the story. And I think having a fancy structure or an interesting structure is fantastic if it is serving the story. But in my case, it definitely wasn't. And so I think maybe at some point early last year, you asked me about this the other day across a dinner table. And I couldn't remember. And I actually have really struggled to try and remember what the writing process for this book was like, because it was written mostly in lockdowns. It was written, I started writing again a couple of months after my mum died. And so it was really just kind of written in this sort of grief-fueled fugue state, which I've completely blocked out of my mind probably in order to be able to carry on with my life and stay in one piece.
I want to ask you a little bit about that process from a couple of different angles. So in the letter that accompanies your book for booksellers and for early readers who got to have an early copy, you describe how this manuscript became a repository for all your feelings after the loss of your mum. And you said it became a way for you to try and understand the different shapes and colours of your grief. Can you tell us a little bit about the different shapes and colours that you write into Marshmallow, because there is really incredibly kind of different tones that come across about how people experience grief?
Yeah, that's such an interesting question. I think we're taught that grief comes to us quite simply, and it's something that you experience in those the Kubler-Ross method, which is the five stages of grief. But I actually think that does a huge disservice and sort of creates a problem for anyone experiencing grief, because there were certain points along the way after mum died where I was like, am I doing this wrong? Because all I wanted to do was lie down and watch action films or watch like repeats of Law and Order SVU. And there was no point of that Kubler-Ross model that kind of explained what I was feeling and why I was feeling them at particular points. And I realized that grief is so nuanced and grief is incredibly personal. And as I said earlier, I wanted to show how people's lived experience can colour the grief that they are experiencing in that one particular time. Mm. So if you've had recent traumas or past traumas, they can pile on top of each other, and it's hard to know what you're experiencing is a reaction to what's just happened, what's happened before, or a combination of everything. So I wanted to have one character who kind of showed that cumulative effect of grief. So that's the character of Al, who you see sort of at the point where we meet him, he's unable to contain his anger and he's drinking too much and he's kind of hiding away from his relationship and not talking to the people around him. And I wanted to show how grief can sort of make you stop for a while and experience time differently. And so that's the character of Annie, who's I don't want to give too much away of the story, but she goes through such a traumatic loss that her life just shrinks and time sort of both slows down and speeds up for her. And then there's people who are sort of shirking their responsibilities. So her husband, Nathan, just can't seem to function. He's trying really hard on the outside to function, but he just goes to work and plays solitaire in the toilet on his phone. And then there's someone who sort of considers running away to a different life because the heaviness of the grief of the people around her is too much for her to handle. And then there's someone who's sort of actually handling it much better than she thinks she is. She's going to therapy and she's doing all the right things, but even for her sometimes it's all a bit too much to bear. So I think it's impossible to explain all the nuances of and the personal side of grief in just five characters, but I just hope that I've kind of done it to a point where maybe some people out there might be experiencing it don't feel so alone in their grief.
I think they absolutely will. In that letter, you went on to say that in the process of writing, you forgot that it would one day be a book and it would be in someone else's hands, and how terrifying that prospect is of it now being out in the world. And I know, because you and I have spoken about this a little bit, that this isn't at all your favourite part of the process, this promotion and going and talking part. Compounding that, you were an author who debuted during lockdown, so you didn't have the kind of normal in real life experience of touring.
The more you talk, the sweatier I'm getting.
we're going to talk. This is like on-air therapy. How are you prepping to manage this part, and what kind of advice have people been giving you, or what are you putting boundaries around to try and get through this part?
I'm sort of taking it day by day because I guess I wrote so much of this just after my mum died. It's sort of like I'm reopening a wound a little bit. I'd really nicely scabbed over, but now with every sort of conversation I have about grief, I feel like I'm picking at the scab a little bit. So I'm just sort of letting people know that I might be a little tender on a day-to-day basis and sort of setting boundaries in that way. But also trying to enjoy, I'm trying to find things to enjoy about it. And I haven't worked out what that is yet, but I'll let you know when I do.
Because what you have done is written this, another book. I was looking at the dates and I was like, hang on a second. Vic's written her second book in 2 years and brought it out, like with the fact that she had lockdown and all this enormous kind of grief that was ongoing in your own life. Are you just going to have a bit of a rest now, Vic, or what's going to happen next?
Yeah, nothing. I'm going to lie down. I'm going to get, I feel like when my first book came out, I had all of these ambitions and ideas of what success looked like. And some of those things I achieved, others were sort of ridiculous now I think about them. But for this one, my expectations have shifted completely. And I'm much more realistic. And I want to, my plan is to try and make it to November in one piece and then leave the country.
Okay, let's talk about leaving the country too, because something I wanted to ask you about was the fact that I know that so much of Kokomo was written in these kind of extraordinary international residences that you had. Was early drafts of Marshmallow written as part of those as well, or was it really most of the writing in your room during lockdown?
The first draft was written at the Wasaic Project, which is in sort of upstate, well, Hudson Valley in New York. So that was 2019. And then everything else after that was written either when I managed to get a desk at a co-working space for the odd week here or there when things weren't locked down, but the rest of it was just in my house.
Do you think it changed the quality? The tone and the feel of the writing being in such an inward kind of space during lockdown?
Yeah, weirdly, my first novel was about someone who hasn't left the house in 20 years. But I think in some ways this Marshmallow feels a little smaller in its scope, but the time frame, it takes place over sort of really about a day and a half. And I think, yeah, being in my house for most of that time really did make this novel just kind of get smaller and smaller as I wrote it.
Do you have a wish list of international residencies that you still want to get to?
It's more like, where do I want to travel to and is there a residency there that I can do? I'd love to go to McDowell one day, which is in New Hampshire, but otherwise, not really. I just like to spend less time in my home. That's my plan for the next year.
Victoria Hannon, you are now a twice published novelist. Have you got advice that you can give to others, or that special advice that you were given that is your favourite advice about the writing process or the publishing process?
I really enjoy, someone said to me recently, if you don't enjoy this, you don't have to do it. You know that, right? And I was like, oh, okay. I feel like I've been driven to do this for so long that I didn't realize that I could just go, I'm just going to have some time off and wait until I want to do it again. So if you're not enjoying it, just don't do it.
Are you telling us that we're going to have to wait a really long time for the third Victoria Hannon novel?
Maybe, but I am seeing my agent in a few days, so she might have other things to say about that.
And Victoria Hannon, can you please leave us with a debut recommendation anytime or any place?
I recently just read Sunbathing by Isabel Beach. This is slight cross promotion because I am appearing with Isabel at Melbourne Writers Festival. It's another grief novel, but I just think she did such an incredible job of just writing that mood of just feeling sort of trapped in your own emotions. And her character goes overseas and spends some time in Italy but you can just feel how sort of closely entwined she is with her own grief. And I thought that Izzy did an incredible job of really just writing that feeling.
So that event is coming up, but it is already sold out, apparently. Is that the one that sold out?
Yeah. But half my friends haven't got tickets, so now I'm really confused as to who actually is going to be there.
Yeah, just punters who want to see you both. So Melbourne Writers Festival, as I have already requested and numerous people have requested on social media, if you could just move that to a slightly larger venue. But you are appearing at Melbourne Writers Festival. Where else can people see you after MWF?
I have an event at Matilda's in Adelaide, which is my childhood bookshop, which is pretty nice. That's September the 14th.
Fantastic.
There will be more to be announced.
Excellent. Where should people look to keep up to date with such things? On your website, Instagram, where should they find you, Vic?
I'd say on my Instagram, so Victoria L. Hannon.
Victoria L. Hannon. It's such a joy to speak with you. I wish you all the love and all the luck for this book going out into the world. And I hope that you have enjoyable times and you find the fun in it as well.
Thank you.
Kylie Meslin is a writer and critic. Her work has appeared in The Guardian, Mianjin, Kill Your Darlings, Adelaide Review, Crikey and Junkie, among other outlets. In 2018, she was the recipient of the Kill Your Darlings New Critics Award, and her essay, I'm Trying to Tell You I'm Not Okay, was longlisted for the Lifted Brow and RMIT Nonfiction Lab Prize for Experimental Nonfiction. Kylie's first book, Show Me Where It Hurts, was shortlisted for the Victorian Premier's Nonfiction Award in 2021, and she contributed to the recently released Melbourne on Film collection with Black Ink. Kylie lives in Adelaide on Kaurna country. Welcome, Kylie, to The First Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, I want to start, as we always do, at the very beginning. Have you always been a writer?
The short answer is kind of no. So I've always loved reading. And writing, but I kind of went down a lot of different paths before I became a writer with a capital W. My first entry point, though, into writing was through criticism. So I started off kind of as a music critic because I was working in the music industry a bit. And then I began a blog that I had for 3 or 4 years where I wrote about what I was reading. And so I was slowly like starting to incorporate more and more.
Was that reviews?
The blog was called Book Plate, and the gimmick was it was about what I was reading and what I was eating. They were paired together. Through this was, I kind of just did it as an exercise because I wanted to write more often. I wanted to really expand what I was doing, and this was a kind of kept me accountable a bit in that it was going out into the world, and remarkably people read it, but I was slowly kind of starting to incorporate more and more personal reflection and more memoir into that, and so that's kind of how I grew into a writer. But I didn't study writing at uni, and I've always really loved writers who have kind of lived beyond the academic experience and have, you know, have lived through some stuff or have come in from different entry points. So like one of my favorite writers, how she was kind of late into writing and so has all this experience that she brings with her. I kind of think of it as, you know, I don't want my politicians to be like having come through that system of having only been a politician. Like I like a politician who has been a teacher or had a small business or has just kind of lived in the world and connects with their electorate in that way. And so for me, I kind of think of the fact that I haven't always been a writer and or I haven't come from this kind of academic background, that is a way that helps me connect with readers in a different way, perhaps.
The politics comparison is such an apt one because I remember John Howard
said that all he'd ever wanted was to be prime minister, which always struck me as that sort of political aspiration that didn't really have vision attached to it. But I like the idea of writers that firstly have something to say, you know, because of their life experience. I love that.
Mm.
Do you remember the first thing that you had published?
Yeah, it would have been music criticism. So I used to write for local street press here in Adelaide, reviewing albums or gigs. I can't remember the exact first piece, but that's what it would have been, yeah.
Did it mean you got to go to gigs and got albums for free? Was there any, was that part of an incentive or was it completely self-funded?
No, I got given them for free, but I didn't get paid for it. Yeah. I was working in the industry and so I wanted to expand my listening world a little bit, and this was a really fun way of coming across stuff that I wouldn't have otherwise. And I really wanted to kind of connect with the local live music scene. And yeah, it was fun. Mm. It was fun.
Ooh. Kylie, your collection of essays, Show Me Where It Hurts, came out in 2020. It is a departure from criticism in some ways, but in some ways you can see the roots of your early writing life in it too. Can you start by giving us the elevator pitch? What is it about?
Sure. So Show Me Where It Hurts is a blend of personal reflection, memoir, and pop culture criticism, which uses visual form, so pop music, TV, film, visual art, to show what it's like living with invisible illness.
It's such an interesting way of communicating, I think, and I want to talk about that. But firstly, how did the book begin? How did you know you wanted to write it? What was the first step?
I had always wanted to write about health, reproductive health, endometriosis in particular, because I hadn't seen it written anywhere. And I started to, as I was kind of building more and more personal reflection in my criticism or in essays that I was working on, it kind of started to form this idea. So I wrote in 2017, I wrote a review of Jenny Valentich's book, Women of Substances, for Kill Your Darlings, and talked about how, like, what I connected with from that book in terms of my own health. And that piece kind of did really well. And then by the time I submitted the edits and it went live, I was in hospital for illness. So then it kind of took a little bit longer to get back into the, to build on that work, I guess. So I wrote a few pieces in 2018 as part of my Kill Your Darlings New Critic. And then in 2018, I got a mentorship with Fiona Wright. And that was really significant in terms of, I wanted to work with her because I knew that I needed help kind of getting my writing to a next level. And she is, you know, she has been deemed the patron saint of sick lit in Australia. And she's also just like incredibly generous and kind to emerging writers who are disabled or living with chronic illness. And part of this, the outcome of this mentorship was to have a proposal and some sample chapters to send to publishers. One of those chapters was, they were the first three chapters of the book. So one was I'm trying to tell you I'm not okay. One was kind of based on the Woman of Substances essay. And then I had a new piece about sex and dating. Submitted that in 2019, and got a deal, which was incredible. But I knew that I wanted to write this book predominantly because I knew that I was the market for this book. This book didn't exist. This book would have changed so much of my life if I had had that representation, if I had had that knowledge and just a connection to other people who were going through similar situations.
It's interesting you say that, and I can completely understand why that would be a primary motivation. But as someone who hasn't had that lived experience, I feel like it was a book written for me because it so
good,
it with such nuance, conveys, communicates an invisible illness experience that by its nature, I suppose, is difficult, is invisible. I'm really interested in this idea, this play that you have between visible things and invisible things. And so invisible illness, but this popular culture. And some examples for listeners are you look at things as well, like Frida Kahlo's work, Beyoncé, Sally Rooney, BoJack Horseman. When you are starting to write these essays, there are 10 essays in the book. Where do you begin? Is it with the specific experience that you want to talk to, or have you started to form a perspective on a particular person or cultural artifact? Can you see a pattern to how the essays start to emerge?
Yeah, it was a little bit of both, but predominantly I have one up on my wall here actually for the next book currently, but I have I had this kind of A3 poster of like, these are the list of topics that I want to talk about. These are the things that are quite predominant to our experience, or I think people wouldn't understand about our experience. And then I would kind of get these ideas about forms that would be useful in showing that, or and I would kind of add to the list. So like my book proposal had a list of like, I want to talk about fertility, but at that point I didn't know what references were going to be there. But then when I was like, I want to talk about housing, and I was like, this will incorporate Golden Girls, Grace and Frankie, and other sources. So I, in laying out the book, I did definitely have that in mind. That was a big part of the planning, was kind of pulling things together. Yeah.
Were some essays surprising for you? Do you think on the page they go in directions that feel unexpected?
Yeah. I mean, I am one of those people that I'm writing and I'm like, huh, okay, didn't know that I thought that or had put that together. The most surprising, though, was the final essay, the last chapter in the book.
I want to talk about this last chapter.
That was the chapter that I wrote last. So I had a bit of reflection on what had come before it. And I really wanted that chapter to, I really wanted it to do a lot. I wanted it to kind of give an ending. I wanted it to, but not a like tie a bow around a kind of ending, like, because that's just not a disabled experience. But it's the only chapter where I cried when I was writing it, and even editing it was quite an emotional experience. That was the one that got me. The rest were certainly difficult at times, given the subject matter, but that was the one that surprised me the most, definitely. And also I should say, I after I wrote it, I realized from the first essay to the last, I had this narrative arc that I was really happy with and really liked, but it had come quite coincidentally, like I hadn't planned that that's how the shape that it would take. So that was great. That was like work that I didn't have to do that I had already done.
it's happening in your subconscious, perhaps. It is an essay that feels like it could only sit at the end of the book. Well, it is an arc. And I feel like I should say that the book charts really difficult times, but there's also light in it. And I think this final chapter is a struggle almost for the right words, because it's hopeful and optimistic, but in a way that you've sort of alluded to, it's not an unrealistic end. It manages to be truthful too. You mentioned that chapters were difficult to write, Kylie. There is a lot of vulnerability in the book in terms of the way that you talk about your life experiences, your fears, all of these sorts of things. How do you balance being vulnerable and writing about that with the personal cost that that can come with?
It was difficult. It was a difficult balance. The short answer to your question is I have an amazing psychologist. there was a lot that was really difficult, and there were times it was difficult writing it. It was almost more difficult to go through the editing process with it, because you're looking at these sentences kind of line by line and really kind of in it, rather than looking at the whole essay or chapter. It was difficult because it was really intentional for me to be very, I guess, not necessarily to be so vulnerable, but to really give to the book, to give. I thought if I'm going to do this, I'm going to go all in, because I think that's the only way that I could have done it, and been true to my own experience and be true to the experience of the disabled community. There's a lot that's in the book. It's very personal, and you know, you'll learn a lot about me very quickly. But there's also stuff that I chose to leave out, whether that was through it still being too close. Like, a lot of the stuff that's in the book is stuff that has happened over the last 20 years of my life. So I kind of had time to process it and be with it. Anything that was kind of really recent, I kind of had to make a bit of a timeline for myself of when I was going to stop. And I think that's something that anyone who's writing memoir or who's writing about a personal experience, it's really difficult to know when to stop that point. And I was also really conscious of what the personal stuff that I was sharing was from my own life. And I really wanted to respect the privacy of my family. And so, you know, there's other stuff that's happened, but it's not my place to write about them, to write through their lens, to, share them with the world. They get enough of just people asking them about the book or wanting to talk about what's going on with me. They don't need their dirty laundry aired.
I did want to talk about one particular chapter or thing in the book, and that is memes, because I cannot stop thinking about them now. Could you tell us perhaps what a meme is for those that might know, but also what do they offer as a medium for communication?
So memes are a combination of visual and text communication, but they're often a little bit disjointed from each other. So I talk a lot about memes specific to SpongeBob SquarePants in the book. And so there will be stills from the cartoon with text then overlaid on that, that gives it a different context. So one example I have in the book is Jolly Little SpongeBob kind of walking into a room, and he's kind of got these like real kind of Fonzie fingers going on, and he is really excited and feeling a bit slick. And there's a chronic illness meme where the text says, like, walking into my doctor's office, like, and so you're, which is so true. I mean, like, all the receptionists at my GP office know me by name, like, so they offer, I think, especially, I mean, I think, you know, they're important for a lot of minority groups, or a lot of, it's, they're just like a, they're a great way of sharing thoughts specific to a particular experience. And I think that, but particularly for disabled people or chronically ill people, we are often lacking the energy to really explain what's going on with us, or we have to kind of save that energy for medical professionals. And so then when people in our lives are asking us about what's going on, it just feels like we're going through this same sharing over and over again. So it's like a shortcut. It's a really great little shortcut. And I think especially for people who are disabled, we live a lot of our life online. We, part of that is by physical circumstance. So, you know, like, it's difficult. I kind of look about 3 o'clock each day, I just lose momentum. Like, I, meds start kicking in, I am exhausted. And so it's quite difficult for me to go out at night nowadays. Or, you know, we catch colds more often, we're more at risk for COVID, you know, there's lots of things in our consideration about socializing. And so memes and that kind of online culture of disabled groups are kind of, have this really great, like, kismet where they're a great shorthand, but they also just bring humor to a situation where, and especially I think for kind of insider things within the sick people communities, it gives us a chance to kind of have a bit of a laugh at ourselves, and that humor, that dark humor in particular, is really key to keeping us going.
It's amazing how they can be both super simple and super complex at the same time. And I would direct listeners to look at Kylie's Instagram feeds. We'll put a link in the show notes because you use them to great effect, and people can check it out there. Kylie, I want to understand what your writing process looks like. You've talked a little bit about it already, but you've also said that, and I think this is very true, we don't talk or hear enough about what writing looks like from a disabled point of view. So what did the writing of Show Me Where It Hurts look like? Was there a typical day or types of day?
At that point in 2019 in particular, where I wrote 7 of the 10 chapters, in 2019.
That's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. I was also still working part-time because COVID hadn't happened, so my job still existed in the world. And it was busy. It was chaotic. It was not good for me, really, to be frank. It was a goal that I had set myself. Like, I'd got funding from ArtsSA and to write the manuscript, and so everything had a timeline and it was all good. But it was really, there was a lot of kind of quite manic energy focused into it, mm-hmm. and lots of like freak outs from stress and stuff. The editing process was a bit more kind and gentle. But yeah, it was, I definitely got to the end of it. I should say also that we, Tex and I made a decision to push the book out a little earlier than normal because of the attention that was happening around endometriosis and how we kind of just wanted to be part of that conversation.
So a big chunk of the conversation was beginning to happen and you wanted to wait for that to peak. Is that what you mean?
No, so there had been an announcement in 2019 that there was a big chunk of federal funding finally given to endometriosis research, and there was going to be like a big forum in 2020. So there was like these timelines, and there was just kind of more and more chat about endo in the news and that kind of stuff. So we just wanted to be a part of that build rather than having missed the moment, I guess, by bringing it out a bit later. So yeah, it was quick, and there were points throughout where both my editor and I were like, hey, we need to not do this next time. And it did mean that I had a lot of burnout in the second half of 2020 and was quite unwell last year. And it also kind of happened at a time where my health was changing, I guess. It's hard to describe, but I was kind of in the last chapter of the book, I kind of talk about how things can be going okay and then these storms appear and you kind of just have to roll with it and then deal and look back on it on the aftermath of this storm and reassess what's going on. And so 2021 was kind of, there was a big storm and there was a big just kind of really needing to change the way that I was working, the kind of pressures that I was putting on myself. So I still have a kind of similar structure in terms of a writing day, but it's just not quite as long. So I generally get up reasonably early, and I once I've had enough caffeine to function, I will sit down and write for a couple of hours and that's it. When I was writing the book, I would have written all morning, had a lunch break, and then edited for a couple of hours in the afternoon, and that would have been a work day. Whereas now I often finish my work day at 10:30, 11:30, and that's it. And then I rest for a bit, have some lunch, and then ideally read in the afternoon. But often, I mean, I have like so many appointments. So I'm often at a doctor's appointment in the afternoon, or I'm too tired to do anything else, so I just need to rest and sleep and do whatever. And I need to be quite dynamic, I guess. Like it's hard to predict what's going to happen. And so one of the chapters in the book, I kind of equate the way that I write to a parent who needs to be able to dump everything if their kid needs picking up from school, or it's just kind of grabbing bits of time in their day when they're able to. That's kind of a similarity in the way that I work. But yeah, coming into the next book that I'm kind of starting to work on, there's been a lot of thinking about how to work better for my health, and a lot of that is removing stress from deadlines that were a little ambitious.
What does that look like? Do you just build more time into a deadline, or greater levels of flexibility? What kinds of things do you say to yourself when you are feeling like, has that been a difficult mental shift?
Yeah, and definitely, like, I feel when it's hard for me to say I'll have this book out in this year or this will happen, and or even just like trying to write a piece to submit for an essay prize, for example, I often really want to do that, get closer to that time and realize that I just can't, like it's just not going to be feasible. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult seeing that, firstly from like it's difficult to me personally because it's just something I want to do and it's just, you know, a real bummer that I can't do it. But it's really difficult also watching my able-bodied peers putting out, who also put out books in 2020, who are now putting out the next book now, or who are really kind of active in their writing careers. It's difficult to watch, and not that I in any way want to take away from their experience, and you know, I'm really proud of the work that they're doing and good for them, but it's a lot of the it's a real kind of crisis of self-worth when you're already very depressed, and the ability to kind of keep up in the world is being taken away from you. It's a really difficult thing to go through. But I've now kind of, switched my world around a little bit to be like, well, health used to happen around work, around when I could, you know, have an appointment after work hours or in a lunch break or that kind of thing. And now my health is my full-time job and writing happens when I'm able to on top of that. Since I put out Show Me Where It Hurts, I'm now on the disability support pension and I'm on NDIS. And so I have this support around me now that takes away a lot of the stress that I was going through while I was writing and putting out Show Me Where It Hurts. It's made irrevocable change to my life for the better. But yeah, it's also just a lot. It's just part of me being sick, and I'm gonna spend, it's gonna be a lifelong challenge to get the balance right and to recognize, especially bipolar is so cyclical, so it's trying to recognize when I'm pushing myself too far in one direction, or just when I just need to kind of down tools and deal with what's happening and then come back when I'm better able to express myself, and also just to have a bit of distance between, because I am a memoir writer primarily, I think I also just need to be able to come back with some space between me and what's happening if I'm going to be able to write about it, or even just to think like, that's not newsworthy. Like, it might be newsworthy to me at the time. It's like something that's happening that's quite taking up a lot of my time, energy and thought, doesn't mean that it's interesting to write about or read about.
It's this cultural emphasis on productivity, it sort of exists around us too, I think. And you can feel, I have certainly felt it, you know, particularly in the early stages of a writing career, that momentum is really important, that one thing happens and you have to be able to deliver on the next thing. But increasingly, I think that's not true. You know, like, I think there is something about momentum, but it can be a bit of a false. I wonder if it is a bit of a false construct as well, this feeling of urgency, and that if you don't get it done now, then it falls away. I might be projecting onto you. I might just be having my own.
No. I felt that. I felt that very much. To the point where the second half of 2020, where there was like, but suddenly, my job didn't exist anymore. I wasn't well enough to do it anyway, so it was okay. But I still had bills to pay. And so I got some grants for like COVID response grants to start working on the next book. And like just so quickly, it was silly really in hindsight. But I felt this real need to like keep up the momentum. Like I don't want anyone to forget who I am just because like I'm not putting stuff out into the world. A million blessings upon Elena and Ian at Text Publishing for the next 6 months of that time where I would come at them with these like, oh, I want to write about this and I think this would be really great and blah, 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 and like, you know, being quite manic. And them very kindly, very generously just being like, hey, let's talk about this. and just really reassuring me that there is no time scale. It just happens when it happens, and that's okay. And the most important thing is writing good work. And it, you know, things can happen and that's fine. They've just been amazing when really kind of from the beginning, despite this, you know, I talked about us wanting to push the book out quickly. At all times they were like, you know, if things get hard, tell us, we'll work it out. Well, that's fine. And from my very first meeting with them, they were asking about my access needs and what if I was going on a publicity trip, like what could they do to help me be able to move around better in a space and stuff like that. So I just, I'm very fortunate to be working with the people that I do, who, despite not having lived experience of it, are really considerate and, they just do it really well.
That's great. Probably a good segue into editing. One of the things that you have said is, I'm also a huge fan of editing while using the extremely, extremely technical Craftanoon method, where pages are printed single side, the segments cut up with scissors and then taped together with scribbles all over them before coming back to the computer and hoping it all makes sense. My entire book was constructed using this technique. This is extraordinary to me. Can you elaborate on this? Is this how you edit?
Yeah. This is how I do structural editing. So I write kind of just in chunks. Like I'll write almost kind of in vignettes, but just bigger. Often when I reach a point where I'm like, I've kind of lost myself here. Or I'm just not sure where things should be. I'm a very visual person. So I often need, in order to understand systems or ideas, I need a chart, I need a diagram. Like in a medical setting, I want a diagram or I want like a model to show me what's happening. I also just work better on paper. It's really fatiguing for me to be at a screen for longer than a couple of hours. I can't do a full day. There's no way I could do a 9-to-5 in front of a screen anymore. So all my research is done on paper with highlighters and pens and notes everywhere. And then editing is the same. So I'll print out what I've got of an essay. And I'll then cut the chunks into their own bits and like I lay it all out on my bed. And then I just start moving things around, or I'll kind of say like this chunk I talk about class and in this chunk I talk about gender and try and think of things thematically or just where is my argument getting a bit bogged down or where do I need to explain something better? And, just physically moving things around and then stapling chunks together, making lots of notes to myself, and then putting, and then I can kind of see on my bed, like, okay, this is what the essay actually looks like. And then I put them all in order, bring them back to my computer, and then that's when I do the copy and paste from on my computer. Once I'm happy then with the draft, then I will print it out and do a manual edit of that.
Wow.
But I don't, yeah, I don't edit on a screen until it's kind of the, like if I'm submitting an essay to, let's say, Kill Your Darlings, I don't do on-screen edits until Alan has sent me back his thoughts and it's in track changes or something. And yeah, it just works for me. It's just the way that I can make it make sense in my brain is literally seeing it laid out in front of me.
It works. Kylie, yeah. Show Me Where It Hurts has been in the world for a little while now. What do you hope that readers take from the book?
I want people in disabled and chronically ill communities, I want them to feel represented and to find a place of belonging in the book. I want them, you know, the greatest thing that has come from this book is people DMing me on Instagram and saying, you know, thank you for this book. I've never felt so seen. That's really, that was the aim of the book, really. A large part of the book was also in trying to build understanding and empathy for people like me from an outsider's point of view. So people who don't have this lived experience, understanding our lives a bit better, and especially if there's someone in their life that is going through some of these things, that they perhaps understand it a bit better. And I think with some distance from the work as well, I hope that people see the kind of disabled rage of the fight for help in lots of different facets of our lives, but also that, like, a life with disability and chronic illness is also really beautiful in lots of ways, and not in not in inspiration porn of disabled people. This kind of, they overcame this, or despite all these challenges, or they struggled their life with this, but still, seeing that a disabled life is still a beautiful life, and especially when it can be made from the person themselves and not by circumstance or according to what's available to them at the time.
That's a pretty good message, and I think having read the book, I found it really profound and moving, and it's a book that's really stayed with me. So congratulations. Kylie, we always ask writers for advice on this show. What is either the best or the worst writing advice you've been given or have for other people?
The best advice I was ever given was to never treat writers as competition, to find your people, build a community, and you'll be a better writer and a better person for it.
The very last question we have is, do you have a debut book recommendation?
Yeah, I mean, there could be so many, and there's a lot of debut books that were really instrumental in my writing of this book. But my recommendation is Katarina Bryant's book, Hysteria, which is a another sick lit book where she talks about the history of hysteria as an idea throughout medicine and how it has kind of overlapped with her own diagnoses. She's a really beautiful writer, and it's a really kind of different perspective on some of these like historical ideas in medicine.
Fabulous. Kylie Meslin, thank you for being on the First Time Podcast.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to the First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.